the economy there is crashing and there's a lot of political turmoil. So they're on the move again. And thousands of Haitians are coming now, landing at the Tijuana-San Diego border asking for asylum.
What happens? I mean, are they granted asylum?
Okay, this gets complicated because when they first started coming to the border, the U.S. was letting them in on humanitarian reasons, just as they had always done for Haitians. But then the numbers of them got bigger and bigger, so U.S. authorities began detaining them, hoping to deter so many from coming. But then Haiti had this devastating hurricane, and it was hard to deport the Haitians. So now the U.S. is back to releasing Haitians and monitoring them on humanitarian grounds. There just aren't as many detention facilities and beds as there are as migrants.
The other group, of course, Carrie, that we have to talk about are unaccompanied minors. A couple years ago, you actually did this story where you sat down with a teenager from Guatemala who was one of these kids. Let's listen to a little bit of it first.
Al día siguiente, los pasaron en una lancha para del río.
Jorge says during his journey through Guatemala and Mexico, he rode in cars, a boat, atop a cargo train for 3 days, and finally sat on a bus for 20 hours before reaching Piedras Negras, right across the border from Eagle Pass, Texas.
En una casa.
We were put in a house for 8 days and given food and everything, the teenager says. 35 other migrants were housed with them. But before they could make the final crossing over the U.S. border, he says Mexican police raided the home. Jorge says he was detained for more than a month in a shelter for underage children, then flown back to Guatemala.
What happened to him? Where is he now?
He got to South Texas on his second try, and he asked for asylum. He was put in U.S. detention for 20 days, and then right before Christmas last year, he was released and flown to his father, who lives in upstate New York.
Wow, so he's been living with his dad for a little more than a year. How's he adjusting to life in New York?
Well, he's a pretty upbeat kid. I've been watching him through the year. We're Facebook friends. And like a lot of American teens, his page is full of selfies and he just got a girlfriend. So lots of pictures about that. But Rachel, he's 18 years old now. And he is in the ninth grade because he only finished sixth grade in Guatemala. His mom pulled him out because of the gang troubles and the violence. So that's tough for him. Mm. And he's also had three court dates since his detention. And all they are just perfunctory check-ins because the U.S. immigration courts are terribly overburdened with all these migrants coming. So the process has been really slow.
So he still doesn't know if he can stay.
No. They have a court date in September. They're hoping to get a definitive answer, and who knows if they will by then because of all the backlog. And I just think this is an interesting question for the incoming Trump administration. It's going to be tough for them to really execute their harder line on immigration.
NPR's Carrie Kahn. Thank you so much, Carrie.
You're welcome.
More sad news yesterday. Just a day after Carrie Fisher passed away, her mother, Debbie Reynolds, has died. Reynolds was an iconic star of movies, television, and the stage. She was admitted yesterday to a hospital in Los Angeles after suffering a stroke. Reynolds was 84 years old, and NPR's Netta Ulaby has our remembrance.
Debbie Reynolds was a teenager when she starred in the movie that made her a screen sensation.
Singing in the rain, just sing.
The female lead of what would become one of the most beloved MGM musicals did not know how to dance when she was cast. Reynolds had studied gymnastics, but for the movie, she practiced tap dancing for up to 14 hours at a time. For the cameras, though, Debbie Reynolds smiled and smiled.
Good morning, good morning.
Everything was hard, you know, all the dance steps and Gene Kelly.
Co-star Gene Kelly was 20 years older. He played Reynolds' love interest, and he choreographed the movie. A few years ago, Reynolds told NPR Kelly was exacting. He made her dance until her feet bled.
But I did it, God was with me, and I learned a great deal from Mr. Kelly.
Over the course of a career stretching decades, Debbie Reynolds would star in more than 50 movies, 2 Broadway shows, and 2 TV series. She recorded Tammy, a number one hit single, in 1957.
I hear the cottonwoods whispering above.
She was born Mary Frances Reynolds in El Paso, Texas. Her father worked on the railroad. After the family moved to California, a talent scout spotted Reynolds at a beauty pageant and whisked her to MGM. There, the teenager attended a studio school with a young Elizabeth Taylor. The two Wanchanoos became fast friends. Later, so did their husbands.
Yes, we were all buddies, you know, We traveled together, went to Europe together. We were riding the high life.
A nation of movie fans was shocked when Reynolds' husband, singer Eddie Fisher, left her for Elizabeth Taylor. His daughter with Reynolds, actress Carrie Fisher, explained that scandal in more contemporary terms during a 2008 appearance on NPR.
My mother and father were the Brad and Jennifer of their generation.
And they stirred up as much publicity as Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston would later on. But Debbie Reynolds kept on working.
Debbie Reynolds gives one of the most fabulous performances in screen history as Molly Brown.
She was nominated for an Oscar for The Unsinkable Molly Brown, and she starred in How the West Was Won. In the meantime, Reynolds married again to a wealthy man with a gambling problem.
He lost all of his money, which was millions, and mine. I guess he ran out.
Then the third husband, who treated her terribly and also took her money.
Well, I guess he needed more. Do I sound bitter? No, I shouldn't do that.
But Reynolds was indomitable. She had a solo cabaret show in Las Vegas and bought a hotel there. She was a philanthropist whose causes ranged from mental illness to the Girl Scouts. She laughed about how her daughter Carrie portrayed her in books and movies. Their relationship was at first strained, then supportive. Later, Reynolds would play a mom to everyone from Albert Brooks to Deborah Messing in the TV show Will and Grace. And she was an excellent Hollywood gossip about Frank Sinatra.
Well, he was a great kisser, very sweet.
They kissed in the 1955 movie The Tender Trap. And Fred Astaire, who she adored, although Reynolds was nervous when they had to dance together in a 1961 movie.
So he said, "Now, Debbie, don't be nervous, and I'll just guide you. You just relax and fly with me." And we just flew around the table, and I didn't dance. I just flew.
After his mother's death, Todd Fisher said yesterday that Debbie Reynolds wanted to be with Carrie.
That's our colleague Netta Ulaby there. And Rachel, that last line there about Reynolds wanting to be with her daughter. You know, she once famously said that childbirth and Singing in the Rain were the two hardest things she had to do in her life.
Filming that movie. So she and her daughter, Carrie Fisher, we know had a difficult relationship at times, but they were closer near the end of their lives. And they respected each other as consummate entertainers. And Debbie Reynolds clearly made Singing in the Rain sound easy. Let's listen to a little bit more of a song from that movie.
I argued the cost, I argued and lost, and now of one thing I'm sure, you are my lucky star. I saw you from afar, two lovely eyes at me. They were gleaming, beaming.
Remembering Debbie Reynolds on NPR.
Good morning. It is 8:18, and this is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up next, we'll be bringing you the latest news from NPR and WPR. Hear the latest on Governor Scott Walker's campaign finance debt from his presidential bid. That story in a couple of minutes.
Support for WGTD comes from the staff of Piasecki Althaus Funeral Home, who understand the holidays can seem hopeless, but there is hope, help, and support by texting HOPELINE to 741741. Someone will listen or be a resource for you to give you help and hope. Text HOPELINE to 741741.
Breedom Drive in Madison. WPR is pleased to support free, family-friendly activities. For more information, visit wpr.org/events.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. The Syrian army has announced a nationwide ceasefire beginning at midnight local time. Rebel groups say they'll support it. The halt in fighting was negotiated by Russia and Turkey. It's expected to lead to peace talks within 1 month. The U.S.-led coalition targeting ISIS militants in northern Syria says it killed a top Islamic State commander. NPR's Alice Fordham says he was hit by an airstrike near Raqqa.
The coalition described Abu Jandal al-Kuwaiti as an ISIS gang leader. He was killed close to a dam that's under threat by Syrian anti-ISIS forces that are backed by the U.S. ISIS is under pressure in their strongholds of Raqqa in Syria and Mosul in Iraq, but its fighters are putting up fierce resistance in Mosul and recently retook the Syrian city of Palmyra.
The president of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, says he's in no hurry to challenge China over island building in the South China Sea. Here's Michael Sullivan.
Even though an international tribunal ruled in the Philippines' favor against China in July, Duterte says he's not ready to bring the matter up, and neither, he said, is China. He said he isn't concerned about Beijing's efforts and said if the U.S. is, it should do something about it, not him.
New claims for jobless benefits in the U.S. are down. The Labor Department says they fell 10,000 last week. They've been trending lower for almost 2 years. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:20. I'm Maureen McCollum. A new campaign finance report shows Governor Scott Walker had about $140,000 in debt remaining from his presidential bid as of last month. That's significantly less than Scott Walker Incorporated's $1.2 million of debt when Walker suspended his campaign in September of 2015. Dave Leventhal of the Center of Public Integrity says Walker has been more successful repaying his campaign debt than many former candidates. He says presidential committees like Walker's will officially stay open at least until they repay any remaining creditors.
They're going to have to keep filing reports with the Federal Election Commission and technically keep their presidential campaigns or their congressional campaign committees open in the hopes that one day they'll be able to clear their debts.
Walker says he hopes to clear his presidential campaign debt by the end of this year. The committee's next federal report is due in January. Wisconsin health officials say flu cases are on the rise as they're urging people to take precautions like getting flu shots. The Wisconsin Department of Health Services said yesterday there have been 161 influenza cases so far this year and 95 hospitalizations. That includes 8 children and 78 adults age 50 and over. Of those hospitalized with influenza, 63% were 65 and older. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the estate of Branna and Irving Sissonwine, supporting the collaborative newsgathering model of NPR and member station newsrooms, which seek to create a network that reflects and illuminates the fabric of America. From Emily and Antoine Van Ochtmeel, supporting New Futures, which works to help low-income D.C. area youth graduate from community college or certificate programs and become financially self-sufficient. Information is available at newfuturesdc.org. And from Focus Features, presenting A Monster Calls, a film about a boy dealing with the complications of life. He finds a most unlikely ally with the monster, voiced by Liam Neeson, who guides him on a journey of courage, faith, and trust. Now playing in select theaters.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm David Green. Creating new national monuments, it's often controversial. Many Americans love the idea of protecting more land, but loggers, ranchers, and others say this comes with a cost. Yesterday, President Obama created 2 new national monuments. One is just east of Las Vegas. It's called Gold Butte. And the other is Bears Ears in southeastern Utah. From member station KUER in Salt Lake City, here's Judy Face.
In a statement yesterday, the president called cultural treasures the reason for creating the 2 monuments. Rock art, archaeological sites, and lands sacred to Native American tribes are included at both Bears Ears and Gold Butte. Obama said he wants to ensure that future generations are able to enjoy and appreciate these scenic and historic landscapes.
There is so much to learn from the land.
Regina Lopez Whiteskunk is a Ute tribal leader who pressed the Obama administration to use the Antiquities Act to create the Bears Ears Monument. She's been part of a coalition of tribes pushing for protection of the 1.3 million acre site.
There's so much that we yet to prepare our next 7 generations for in being able to continue to live in unison with the land.
Bears Ears will be the first national monument to be co-managed by the federal government and tribes. Conservation groups are also applauding the designation. Drilling and mining aren't allowed on national monuments. But many locals and elected officials in Utah are denouncing the move and vow to derail it. They say it will restrict how they use the land for ranching, for logging, and other forms of economic development. Utah Republican Congressman Rob Bishop has proposed legislation that would have blocked Bears Ears and future monuments.
This is a political statement, and it got your moment.
by a president as he's leaving the White House to try and pay back whomever he thinks are special interest groups that are supporting him.
Opponents of Bears Ears have already spoken to the incoming Trump administration about reversing the monument designation, although past repeal attempts have failed. The 300,000-acre Gold Butte Monument in Nevada could prove just as controversial. It's located along the border with Arizona, where federal agencies and locals have clashed before over land management. Opponents of these designations say they want Congress, not the president, to have the authority to name monuments. For NPR News, I'm Judy Faze in Salt Lake City.
The change of power in Washington, D.C. next year could mean changes to the rules that govern the nation's banks. One big idea for new rules comes from Neel Kashkari. He was the man who ran the government's bank bailouts during the financial crisis. As Jacob Goldstein of our Planet Money podcast reports, Kashkari says his plan would make another bailout much less likely.
In 2008, Neel Kashkari was working in Washington for the Treasury Department. The banks were collapsing, and he got put in charge of the bailout. It was a big job. How old were you at the time?
I was 35 at the time.
And how much money were you in charge of?
The program's maximum size was $700 billion.
Kashkari became the face of the bailout, got yelled at a lot in Congress.
Mr. Kashkari, we told you in there that we wanted Treasury to safeguard the TARP monies from waste and abuse.
I'll tell you, Mr. Kashkari,
the people that don't have savings are bailing out the very wealthiest in this country. There's something inherently wrong in this picture.
And then, in the spring of 2009, Kashkari left his job in Washington. He moved to the mountains of Northern California.
One of the things I liked to do when I was in the woods was chop wood. So, trust me, when I was sitting there chopping wood, I was reliving some of my moments taking my beatings on Capitol Hill. What I realized is when you violate the core beliefs of a society, it leads to great anger in that society. And so as a society, we have a core belief that's been passed down from generation to generation in free markets. If you take a risk, you get the upside, you get the downside. Well, we violated that fundamentally when we bailed out the banks.
Kashkari is now the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, part of the National Federal Reserve System. And he says if the nation's banks got into trouble today, they would be bailed out again. He says they're still too big to fail. The problem, according to Kashkari, is debt. We think of the banks as lending out money, but banks also borrow lots of money. And when a bank gets into financial trouble, it can't pay back all that money it borrowed. In the case of a really big bank, this can set off a chain reaction that causes problems throughout the economy. So Kashkari and his team in Minneapolis came up with a plan they say would make future bailouts less likely. Don't let the banks use so much borrowed money. Force them to use more of their own money. Money they haven't borrowed from anyone and don't have to pay back.
We decide that banks need much higher buffer so that if they make mistakes, they have enough buffer to absorb those losses.
Today, big banks borrow about 93% of the money they lend out. The other 7% is their own money. 7% is their capital in the jargon of banking. For the biggest banks, Kashkari says, that number should be twice as high.
The rough measure is 15%. Will have to come out of their own money, their capital, as we call it.
The rest, they can still borrow. One group that does not like Kashkari's plan, big banks. For this story, I reached out to the two trade groups that represent big banks. Neither one of them got back to me. But when Kashkari's plan was released, a spokeswoman for one of the groups, the Financial Services Forum, said, quote, "For those looking to accelerate economic growth and job creation, tripling bank capital levels, already double from pre-crisis levels, will make it much harder to meet those goals." In other words, the plan will be bad for economic growth. Kashkari more or less agrees with this.
Safety isn't free. If we raise capital requirements, make the banks fund themselves with their own money instead of borrowed money, there will be an economic cost.
Specifically, Kashkari says, his rules would make it more expensive for ordinary people and businesses to borrow money. Interest rates would be higher. Economic growth, he says, would be a little lower. For Kashkari, this trade-off, higher interest rates, lower economic growth, in exchange for a much lower risk of a financial crisis, is worth it. It will be up to Congress and the president to decide whether to adopt the rules. Jacob Goldstein, NPR News.
So
Support for Planet Money comes from Hiscox Insurance, providing customized insurance for small and medium businesses so they can do more and be more. Learn more at HISCOX.com or from an agent. Hiscox Insurance. Encourage courage.
This is NPR News.
The Michelangelo of automobile design was once rejected from the nation's top design schools because of his race.
There's a phrase in the African-American community called making a way out of no way. That is, if confronted with obstacles, you still find a way.
I'm Robert Siegel. The story of General Motors design chief Ed Welburn, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Make sure to catch All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 today here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. It is 8:30. Hope you're enjoying the day. Thanks for being with us here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Still to come this hour, 2016 was another year in the war on cops. The perception among rank and file law enforcement that they're being targeted. We'll hear more on that story in about 15 minutes. In Wisconsin news, Governor Scott Walker is headed to Cuba to visit Wisconsin National Guard troops at Guantanamo Bay. The Department of Military Affairs is flying Walker and his entourage to the military base this morning. The Milwaukee-based 32nd Military Police Company is providing support for the Joint Task Force Guantanamo and the Joint Detention Group. The task force operates detention camps for prisoners captured in Afghanistan and elsewhere since the September 11th terrorist attacks. Military Affairs Lieutenant Colonel Gary Thompson said today Walker will visit with the troops but won't have any contact with prisoners. The governor plans to return to Wisconsin tomorrow. Tommy Thompson, a former Wisconsin governor and U.S. Health Secretary, has met with Donald Trump on the dismantling of Obamacare, but neither has indicated what was talked about at their meeting yesterday. The Republican Thompson supported the repeal of President Barack Obama's Affordable Care Act when Thompson unsuccessfully ran for the U.S. Senate in 2012. He also spearheaded the start of Badger Care. That's the state's Medicaid health insurance program for the poor. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Kimberly-Clark Corporation, home of Kleenex, Huggies, and Kotex brands. More information about Kimberly-Clark's 144-year history is available on the web at kimberly-clark.com.
Supporting WGTD is the Metropolitan Opera, whose next high-definition simulcast is Saturday, January 7th, Giuseppe Verdi's early masterwork Nabucco at Kenosha's Tinseltown and Racine's Renaissance Theater. More information at metopera.org.
Snow showers are likely later today in Wisconsin. Highs will be near 30 degrees. And tonight there is a chance of snow showers with temperatures back down to the teens. And for tomorrow, chance of snow in the afternoon and evening with highs in the lower to mid-20s.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, where teams of medical experts focus on the treatment of only one disease, cancer, every stage, every day. Learn more at cancercenter.com. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning, I'm David Green.
And I'm Rachel Martin. Amazon's personal assistant device called Echo was one of the most popular gifts this Christmas. It's a voice-activated gadget that can play music, catch up on the news, search the web for information, even control lights or security cameras if you have a smart home. But this week, Amazon's device grabbed headlines for a very different reason. Police in Arkansas are trying to use its data in a murder investigation. NPR tech blogger Alina Selyuk is here to tell us about it. Hi, Alina.
Hi, and we should start with a disclaimer that if you are listening to NPR in the vicinity of Amazon Echo, it may turn on now as we refer to the voice assistant that powers it called Alexa.
You've been warned. Okay, so first, Alina, walk us through what happened in this Arkansas case.
What we know from court documents is that a man in Arkansas had some friends over at his house to watch a football game, and this was more than a year ago. And then in the morning, one of the friends was found dead in a hot tub in the backyard, and the police later charged the man who lived in the house with murder, but he has pleaded not guilty.
All right, so how does the Amazon Echo factor into this?
As the police were investigating the crime, they found a number of digital devices in the suspect's house, an alarm system, a smart water meter, and an Amazon Echo device. It was in the kitchen, and what they want to check is what, if anything, the device may have recorded on the day of the murder.
Because we should just point out, when the device is activated for a couple of seconds, it will record the ambient sound in an environment.
That's right. So Echo is always listening for the wake word or trigger word, which usually is Alexa. But the storage capacity on the actual device is pretty minimal, so it's kind of constantly writing and rewriting tiny bits of audio. But then when you do say the trigger word, the little blue light turns on, and anything you say gets sent to Amazon servers where the recordings get stored. And that's what the police want. They've served a search warrant to Amazon for the audio or transcripts they may have on their servers.
All right, so what is Amazon saying?
Amazon has complied with part of the search warrant. They've turned over information about the suspect's account and purchases, but they're fighting the request for recordings from its servers, and the company says it objects to, quote, overbroad or otherwise inappropriate demands.
But clearly the police believe or at least suspect there's something relevant in these recordings.
And that's tricky. It's not clear what, if anything, is there. They're asking for 2 days' worth of recordings. And, you know, some Alexa users have experienced that creepy situation when the device turns on and starts talking without being triggered. So the police maybe hope that the Echo in this case may have recorded something at least by accident.
So this all brings to mind that case where the FBI was trying to get the information from the iPhone after the San Bernardino shootings, and they were trying to get Apple to release that to them. Is it similar?
It is another example of the law enforcement turning to a tech company for access to personal data. And the defense side in the Arkansas case is really stressing the suspect's right to privacy. He was in his own home. And, you know, the privacy experts have long predicted a wave of these kinds of cases. As we connect more things to the internet in our houses, these devices will become involved in more crime investigations. And interestingly, even in this case, investigators are also using information from a smart water meter to argue that lots of water was being used on the night to clean up, presumably, the crime scene.
NPR tech blogger Alina Selyuk, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, so as we just heard, there are cases when the government wants access to more information. The government also sometimes controls how much information it puts out. And there is this inherent tension in trying to keep national security secrets in an open society. That is what is playing out as the CIA and other spy agencies race to finish a report on Russian hacking. It's due before President Obama leaves office on January 20th. The challenge, how to reveal what facts they know without revealing how they know them. Here's NPR's Mary Louise Kelly.
The task sounds straightforward enough. Lay out the evidence that Russia interfered in the election. White House Homeland Security Advisor Lisa Monaco describes it as a lessons learned exercise.
The idea here is to capture everything we know in one place and make as much of it public as possible, consistent with national security and protecting sources and methods.
And there's the rub, how to protect sources and methods in Russia, one of the most hostile environments for American spies. We put a question along these lines to CIA Director John Brennan. Just saying, hey, we're the CIA, trust us, doesn't cut it in 2016. People want to see the evidence for themselves. How much will you be able to make public of what you know?
I believe that this administration is going to try to inform the American people as much as possible about what happened.
But Brennan's job is to ensure that clandestine intelligence continues to flow.
It's always a balance when you need to go out publicly with information, but at the same time, protect that which needs to be protected.
What needs to be protected includes technical capabilities that may have taken years and millions of dollars to develop. Think listening devices, cyber spyware. Steve Hall retired from the CIA in 2015 after 3 decades running Russian operations. He frames the challenge this way.
When you start asking questions like, well, forensically, you know, how can you prove or how can you be sure that this is Russia or this is Putin or this is the Kremlin? You start revealing, well, you know, this is what we have, this is what we know. And the Russians are very good at determining, okay, well, if they know that, then they must have gotten it this way.
Hall says the stakes are even higher when dealing with human sources.
having been a case officer for 30 years, there have been a number of times when you sit down across from a human asset, a spy, who you've recruited by saying, yes, we can protect you, and have them look at you in the eye and say, okay, no, seriously, this is really sensitive stuff. Can you guarantee me that myself and my family will not be executed or suffer some horrific fate because maybe one of your politicians wants to make this too public?
This is Hall's first formal interview. He comes from an institution that by instinct values discretion, closed lips. Hall says that's even more important when dealing with Russia than it would be if the task at hand were building a public case against, say, ISIS.
There's been no ISIS penetration of CIA or the U.S. intelligence community. They haven't recruited spies inside of CIA or NSA. The Russians, on the other hand, have.
Which prompts the CIA and the National Security Agency to practice great caution. Hall says even two CIA officers sitting right next to each other often don't know who the other's sources are. Imagine then the furious writing and rewriting underway this very moment as U.S. spy agencies prepare to lay out evidence before the world on what they know about Russia's cyber activities. Mary Louise Kelly, NPR News, Washington.
And we should mention this afternoon on All Things Considered, with the Obama presidency winding down, the guessing game has begun. Who will be offered clemency? Edward Snowden? Maybe Chelsea Manning? The White House says don't anyone get your hopes up. That's this afternoon on All Things Considered. This is NPR News.
It's 8:41 on this Thursday morning, and this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay with us. Headlines are next, and in 10 minutes on Morning Edition, 24-year-old jazz crooner Omar Kamal was born in the town in the West Bank. He says it was a very turbulent area when he was growing up, and ahead we'll hear from this singer, who some fans call the Palestinian Frank Sinatra. Hear him sing in 10 minutes.
WPR has been a radio pioneer since 1917. That's nearly 100 years of great radio. We're proud of our legacy, and we're grateful for the listener support that makes it possible. Thanks to you, WPR's bright future includes more in-depth news, world-class music, great discussions, and entertainment. To continue the spirit of innovation, make your year-end gift now at WPR.org. Thank you.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. A nationwide ceasefire takes effect in Syria at midnight local time. It was announced earlier today. It's expected to lead to peace talks within 1 month. Russian investigators say they've reached some conclusions after analyzing data from two flight recorders recovered from the crash of a Russian military plane in the Black Sea. That crash killed all 92 people aboard. NPR's Lucianne Kim has more from Moscow.
Russian Transportation Minister Maxim Sakhalov said rescuers have recovered everything that's connected to the crash, including the remains of passengers and the plane's black boxes. Although they can't completely rule out terrorism, authorities say there was no explosion on board. Sakhalov said it's clear the plane had technical problems, and now experts are trying to find out why.
Most of those killed in the Christmas Day plane crash were members of the Russian Army Choir heading to Syria. President Obama is designating two more national monuments in the final weeks of his presidency. NPR's Nathan Rott says one is in Utah, the other is in Nevada.
More than 1.6 million acres in Nevada and Utah will be protected from development under Obama's designations. But the future of the newly anointed Bears Ears and Gold Butte National Monuments is uncertain. Lawmakers are calling it an executive overreach and asking President-elect Donald Trump to undo Obama's executive actions. That would likely take congressional backing.
I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:43. I'm Maureen McCollum. In the wake of long patient wait times revealed in a 2014 government audit, the U.S. Veteran Affairs Department is making a change to increase the number of primary care providers. What are known as advanced practice nurses will be able to do more for patients without the supervision of a doctor. David Murray is Associate Director of Patient Care Services at the Madison VA Hospital.
Our wait times here have dropped well below 15 days. We do have it set up that anybody that needs to be seen emergently, they have same-day access.
Murray says the average wait time for routine primary care is 4 days. Assembly Minority Leader Peter Barca is promising Democrats will be more focused this session. Assembly Republicans entered the session with a 64-35 edge, their largest since 1957. Barca said yesterday that President-elect Donald Trump's momentum and district boundaries that favor Republicans contributed to GOP gains in November. He hopes a court ruling striking down the boundaries will stand and help Democrats gain ground in 2018. He says he does not plan to run for governor, but expects to start recruiting assembly candidates next week, months earlier than usual. Meanwhile, he says Democrats will hold more rural hearings to connect with voters and will focus on big issues such as helping the middle class with a higher minimum wage. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations. And from American Jewish World Service, working for 30 years to end poverty and advance human rights worldwide. Learn more at AJWS.org. From Epson. Epson robots are used by manufacturers throughout the world to produce consumer electronics. Where there's business, there's Epson. Learn more at Epson.com/forbusiness. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working with others to build a culture of health for all. On the web at RWJF.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning, I'm David Green.
And I'm Rachel Martin. Police will remember 2016 as a grim chapter in what some of them started calling the war on cops. As NPR's Martin Costi reports, the ambush killings this year led police to feel like they were under siege.
The darkest moment for American police this year was July 7th in downtown Dallas, when police officers doing security for a peaceful protest march suddenly found themselves under attack.
These law enforcement officers were targeted, and nearly a dozen officers were shot. Five were killed.
And those weren't the only cops targeted this year. Deadly ambushes followed in Baton Rouge, Des Moines, Palm Springs.
There has been an increase in the total number.
That's Seth Stoughton, a former cop, now an assistant professor of law at the University of South Carolina. He's been tracking premeditated murders of law enforcement officers, what he calls police assassinations. And he says the number of police killed like this has jumped from 5 or 6 last year to somewhere in the neighborhood of 8 to 12 this year.
It looks like a huge increase, and it is a huge increase, but it's a huge percentage increase involving very small numbers.
12 deaths, horrible as they are, have to be put into the statistical context of a country with close to 1 million law enforcement officers. Stoughton says statistical context is important.
On the other hand, it's not helpful at all because police officers don't feel any less under siege, don't feel any less threatened because I pull up a spreadsheet.
And that's where this gets tricky. For the last couple of years, academics and police reform groups have been pushing back against the idea of a war on cops by citing big picture statistics. For instance, the fact that overall far fewer police are killed on duty now than a generation ago. But those cold stats sometimes aren't enough to change perceptions. Major Max Guerin says he's been hearing the phrase war on cops a lot this year from his fellow officers.
They use it in social media, they use it in their discussions, and for many officers there is that belief.
Guerin himself doesn't like the phrase war on cops, but he understands where it comes from, especially where he works, in the Dallas Police Department.
The human brain is a narrative processor, and the stories and the things that these officers particularly witnessed serve to reinforce the idea that they're being victimized, that they're being attacked, whether that is in fact the overall case or not.
The belief in a war on cops can have real political consequences. It's been used as an argument against police reform movements such as Black Lives Matter, and it also led many rank-and-file officers to support Donald Trump during the campaign. And it's not just a left-right thing. Gun control groups are also making an issue of police deaths. Without going so far as talking about a war on police, the group Every Town for Gun Safety says shootings of police are an argument for stricter background checks on gun sales. Sarah Tofty is the group's research director.
What we're seeing is more cops are being shot in states without background check laws. And, you know, I think a piece of that is, you know, fewer dangerous individuals are able to get easy access to firearms.
Politics aside, the war on cops is also having a practical effect on everyday policing. In Dallas, Major Guerin says the officers there are now being more cautious. They're more likely to wait for backup, which he thinks is a good thing. but he doesn't want that caution to become something darker.
Along with the discussions about safety and security, we as leaders need to continue to push the message of empathy with our citizenry. They're not the enemy.
After an attack like the one in Dallas, he says police have to fight the tendency to see the job as a matter of us versus them. Martin Costi, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
It's 10 minutes before 9 o'clock. Good morning. You are listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Hope you really enjoy your day today. Thanks for being with us and stay tuned. We'll be bringing you more for Morning Edition next. And then classical music starts at 9 o'clock.
Support for WGTD comes from Kenosha Winter Harbor Market, closed in observance of the holidays. The market will reopen at the Rohde Center for the Arts Saturday, January 7th at 10 and close for the day at 2. For more, visit KenoshaHarborMarket.com.
...and compassion. February 9th at the Majestic Theater in Madison. Information at WPR.org/love.
Cloudy day today in Wisconsin. Snow showers are likely later with highs near 30 degrees. And tonight there is a chance those snow showers could continue into the evening with lows dropping down to the teens.
Marketplace, Fresh Air, A Prairie Home Companion. These programs and many more are possible thanks to listener support. You can learn about WPR programs, schedules, and so much more at WPR.org. Thank you.
Support for WGTD comes from Andrea's. With homemade soups, salads, and sandwiches being served daily at their historic soda fountain. Stop by Andrea's today for lunch and an old-fashioned soda.
Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm David Green. And Rachel, are you game for some reporting from the Middle East that is going to sound really different?
Sure. Let's do it.
Just listen to this.
I'm sentimental, so I walk in the rain.
Wow, that is not what I was expecting, and very beautiful.
Yeah, they call him the Palestinian Frank Sinatra, and I've got to say, when we were recording this interview, I think I might have seen some of our colleagues blushing.
I happen to have seen a picture of this guy floating around. Quite good looking, easy on the eyes. Tell me more about him.
So his name's Omar Kamal. He's 24 years old. Yeah, certifiable heartthrob. He's a jazz crooner. He was born in Nablus, which is a town on the West Bank that he says is quiet now, but he grew up there during a really turbulent time. He was 8 years old, and the uprising that's known as the Second Intifada was going on. Roadblocks, curfews all around the town, and he spent a lot of time in the safety of his own home.
He wasn't really open to the world, and hence there wasn't much to do in terms of going out and restaurants and things like that. So it was always whatever you can do at home.
I sit and daydream. I got daydreams galore.
I'm not trying to pick this up from a fairy tale, but I think music was always the escape from your reality. To have that little space where you can be creative and kind of dream and move away from everything that's happened around you.
And that longing for escape came as he was learning piano, and one voice, one song grabbed him.
Fly me to the moon, let me play among the stars, let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars.
From there, it kind of developed into an obsession, but I think Frank Sinatra has got all credit for me going into singing.
You must remember this. A kiss is still a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh.
So this music is from Omar Kamal's first album, Serenade, that is out soon. He worked with an extraordinary cast of veteran producers and actually recorded some of the songs at the legendary Capitol Studios in Hollywood, where Frank Sinatra recorded. That must have been amazing.
Yes, yes, that was surreal. I mean, and someone told me that the microphone I sang on was Sinatra's microphone. Yeah, I don't know if that was just a myth, but
God, that's incredible. I would have thought they would have updated microphones by this point, but that's awesome.
No, those microphones are just keepers.
Were you nervous?
I was very nervous. I was trying to, you know, to keep it together around all of these people, but it was a great experience.
And one of his producers had this crazy idea. I mean, if he can pull off Frank Sinatra, what about Bruce Springsteen?
You're riding in my car. I turn on the radio. I'm pulling you close. You just say no.
Of course, he did put his own spin on it.
Oh, when we kiss, oh, fire.
So it starts out with the original bass line, and then suddenly at midway through, you've got this transition in the rhythm, and then it starts swinging.
You had a hold on me right from the start. A grip so tight I couldn't tear it apart. My nerves all jumping, I feel like a fool. Your kisses, they burn, but my heart stays cool.
Well, how do your songs go over with Palestinian audiences?
Yeah, this is a tricky one. People here in Palestine really appreciate what I'm doing and the way I'm going about it. But it's a question of taste and music, because music is always related to your culture. But I think it's going to take some time to get more people on board.
Because I wondered, I mean, you know, there are other Palestinian musicians who will sing nationalistic songs and will sing for a cause. And I guess I was curious if there's that expectation and you face some disappointment from people who would rather be hearing you use your talents in that way.
I think there's a time and place for each. I think it comes down to your art and what you want to do. You know, you can't always be that type of artist or the other, you know, or at least for me, I want to explore as many genres and areas as I can.
Round like a circle in a spiral, like a wheel within a wheel, never ending or beginning on a never spinning reel.
Now, in one interview, Omar Kamal had said that being a Palestinian musician can be a good thing and also a bad thing. And I asked him what he meant by that.
It's kind of a tricky one for me and for my background. And you might have racism all over the world. And racism is vicious and can always affect people. It doesn't matter where they come from. So, and me being a Palestinian might have that card played against me, so.
I hear you saying that there's no way to get away from the politics and that there's some people who might embrace you and want to support you because of everything that you have been through, and there's some people who, as you were saying, because of racism and so forth, might shun you, and there's no way to get away from
exactly.
That judgment.
But in both cases, you know, I would hate to be a charity artist that, you know, people just support for his backstory. I mean, I just want to be presented with the same equal opportunity as everyone else as an artist.
Do you have one of your pianos nearby?
Yeah, actually, I have a couple.
Is there something you could play for a minute or so as we say goodbye?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm just going to try. I haven't played this for some time now. Fly me to the moon. Let me play up there with those stars.
I mean, come on.
Rachel Martin, your face looks like you're enjoying this.
Yes. Yes, I am.
Okay. That is Omar Kamal. He's a Palestinian musician, and his new album, Serenade, is coming out next month. And you heard him right here on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Rachel Martin.
In other words, darling, kiss me.
You've been listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. More news coming up this afternoon on All Things Considered at 4 o'clock.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin Extension, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association.
Support for WGTD comes from Carthage College, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. More information is available online at carthage.edu/grad.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn.